that what actually what undergirds the world itself is alive in some sense, or has that eternal principle to it. And it would be consistent with Pharicides also trying to ground the, you can't use the word creation, but the explanation for the gods in an eternal principle. The gods are time. The gods are this substrate itself, the winged oak. The gods are Zas. I think that, again, maybe Aristotle is reading into it a bit when he says that Pharicides tried to make the Ariston the best, the Arche, but Zas isn't emphatic. So there is something there that I think is interesting.
I think with Thrasides, you see this very interesting, like, turn that becomes obviously a much bigger a thing with Thales, and in a similar degree as Anaximander and Xenemes and stuff like that, who we've talked about previously, where, as you're saying, like, the gods, you kind of drop the noun aspect of them, and they become an active force, right? And, you know, as, like, you know, Kronos being an obvious one, active force of time, and then basically saying, like, we're kind of getting to that zone of first principles that we've been so much engaging with our other, you know, with the more traditional pre-Socratics. And obviously there's some differences there because it's so much more tied up with mythology, but this idea that, like, no, like, if we're looking for the sort of bottom of the barrel, if we're looking for the deepest explanation, here are the gods. But most importantly with this is, and here's why they are the primary thing. Here's why they are the bottom. And I think that's what makes Thrasides so, funnily enough, he's like the proto-pre-Socratic, the pre-pre-Socratic. Because he's at least, as you mentioned, it's like Hesiod and, you know, Greek mythology in general at the time would have been much more just like, there are gods, you know, to the chagrin of many, they act just like people. They're hanging out and they're at war with each other. But there's no explanation for, like, why or how, other than, like, a genealogy or, like, family history.
Yeah, you can explain the kind of causal history, but you want to ask, like, why is there even a causal history there at all to begin with? Which I think that's an explanation for the possibility or the occurrence of anything at all. That's a very philosophical impulse. That's a very philosophical worry to have. This is kind of the critical theology episode, because I want to connect now Pharicides to Xenophanes. It's quite a jump to make. We skip right over the Milesians, but we covered them. That's fine. The reason I'm connecting these two is because Xenophanes is obviously reacting to the in having a critical theology, you have to react to the people who have been explicating that theology, who have been giving you that picture. Xenophanes is responding to the received understanding of the Greek gods and the pantheon at the time, as understood by Homer and Hesiod. But Xenophanes is going to, he has the hindsight of the Ionian thinkers, of the Milesians. He has the hindsight of having this idea of a grounding arche, a first principle. So we are making a bit of a jump from Pharicides to Xenophanes, but that's okay, because they are both responding to the same kind of received picture of the gods. Now, I think that if we want to get a contrast between what Pharicides is doing and what Xenophanes is doing, there is this really interesting kind of process that Slavoj Žižek actually introduces in the preface to his book, The Sublime Object of Ideology, where he says, look, when you're looking at a discipline and it's changing, ask yourself whether it is a mere Ptolemization or a real Copernican revolution, right? A Ptolemization just means you stay within the basic framework, but you just, like, add stuff to account for weird anomalies. Or a Copernican revolution is where you just, like, throw out the whole framework and adopt a radically new framework that's just not compatible with how you were thinking before. I think in certain ways you can see Pherecydes as kind of Ptolemizing the Hesiodic picture. He's introducing these really important ideas that are going to get picked up by the pre-Socratics, but their implications are not fully realized until you get to the point of the Milesians, until you get to Xenophanes applying these ideas to the gods, where you get a radically different picture of what is going on, right? I think if we get into the fragments, we'll talk a little bit about Xenophanes, because there is a biographical fragment.
So this is the first fragment we have. And just so people know, Xenophanes lived roughly from 570 BC to 478 BC. He famously lived like a really long time. He apparently died when he was 92. So Xenophanes, son of Dexois, or according to Apollodorus of Orthomenes of Colophon, being expelled from his native land, passed his time in Zulce in Sicily and in Catana. He wrote in epic meter, also elegiacs and embaics, against Hesiod and Homer, reproving them for what they said about the gods. But he himself also recited his own original poems. He is said to have held contrary opinions to Thales and Pythagoras, and to have rebuked Epimenides, too. He had an extremely long life, as he himself somewhere says, already there are 67 years tossing my thought up and down the land of Greece, and from my birth there were another 25 to add to these, if I know how to speak truly about these things.
So there is a word for it, but he lived quite a long time. The other point that I wanted to make about this too was that, like Thales, he traveled. So he went around and he collected these stories about the gods and recited them, but he also composed his own stuff. So I think what is interesting is that you get these changes and these shakeups in thought when, at least at this time, and maybe even, like, I'm thinking specifically of Descartes, who found his travels really intellectually formative. Traveling around is really important for encountering new ideas, spreading them, synthesizing them, finding different things to need to explain.
Homer and Hesiod ascribe to the gods whatever is infamy and reproach among men, theft and adultery and deceiving each other. So, I mean, already with the first fragment, we're getting into that. Xenophanes is pointing out the fact that, you know, in a prior fragment, giving a little bit of his biography, he was specifically known for rebuking Homer and Hesiod, who obviously, you know, wrote these epic poems or created these epic poems about, you know, about the gods and their deeds and their activities and their drama, and made them extremely humanized, very anthropomorphic, the whole sort of situation, the whole story. And here he's immediately pointing out, like, Homer and Hesiod ascribe to the gods basically all bad stuff, stuff that we don't like about people, or we find appalling, or we want to rebuke about others, you know, in these traditional, what are effectively religious stories.
There is a sort of, there's hidden in there already the Platonic critique of the gods, or of the depiction of the gods, right? As if we go into the other fragments, we'll find that Xenophanes is not opposed to depicting the gods. In fact, he extols the virtue of piety and being faithful to the gods. It's just that what the true god is one, as we'll find out, and that these gods are not being painted in a good light. They're not good gods. They're not people that are worth being pious to. I don't know if the charge of projection is the thing that Xenophanes is trying to say here, that, oh, we just kind of project what we think is bad onto the gods. I think maybe that is, it's in there. But specifically, this idea that the gods could have anything bad about them, that's not... what is blameworthy is Homer and Hesiod attributing bad things to the gods. And as we find for Xenophanes, the god is good.
Mortals suppose that the gods are born and have clothes and voices and shapes like their own. So this is obviously a very... I'm not sure that there's a lot of anthro projection going on. it's hard to have characters like out of ether. Do you know what I mean? So instead, we're going to have them, you know, have, you know, be born and have parents and have clothes and voices and sound a certain way and have personalities and look like us. But this leads into the next. I'll just go right into the next fragment. That's one of my personal favorite. But if oxen and horses and lions had hands or could paint with their hands and fashion works like men do, horses would paint horse-like images of gods and oxens like oxen ones, and each would fashion bodies like their own.
Yeah, and continuing that theme in the next fragment, I have the Ethiopians consider the gods flat-nosed and black, the Thracians blue-eyed and red-eyed. So correct myself, there is this aspect of projection going on, that the image of the gods that we have is based on it has to be based on something. I think the observation that you can't just generate gods out of the ether, I think that's a good sort of explanation of why we have to have images. Well, we have to have images because we're trying to imagine them. Well, where do those images come from? Well, they have to come from somewhere. They have to come from us. Those are the only, you know, if we're not well traveled like Xenophanes, those are the only images people that will have.
Yeah, but again, this is where, you know, guys like Xenophanes, it's funny calling Xenophanes a guy, as Xenophanes, sorry, but I guess he was. But pre-Socratics like Xenophanes are so important because it's this real radical shift. They're almost like first of all, there's enough introspection and examination of our own, you know, mythological processes that basically he can like dissect those and say, okay, this is what everybody thinks. This is what's going on. Everybody's kind of participating in this. And they're wrong. Right. Like we can see, like I can understand why they're doing that. It makes sense why they're doing that. It makes sense why we historically as a community have kind of imagined things collectively in this way and participate in the activity of our, you know, effectively our religion in this way and culture. And it's incorrect, right? Like it's not like, and that, like you were saying, is the kind of, I think, part of the Copernican turn, where instead of trying to be like, okay, how can we make the gods in this system make a little bit more sense? You know, we have all these stories, they must be true, you know, but like, let's sort of, you know, tilt things a little bit here. Let's work.
Yeah. Let's move it to the left a little.
Yeah, exactly. So that you kind of, you know, it explains the world a little better. You know, Xenophanes is kind of, you know, it's kind of throwing it at a little bit. Like if we go to the next one, this is the huge turn that goes, but there is one God among gods and men, the greatest, not at all like mortals in body or mind.
Right. Yeah. This is the real kind of stake in the anthropomorphic picture.
Yeah. Yeah. He sees as a whole, thinks as a whole, and hears as a whole. This is going to be, you know, this reminds me of like, eventually we're going to, Parmenides is not far off, a favorite of you and I. But there's this kind of monism already coming in where it's like, to me, when I read this, like my own interpretation is Xenophanes is really thinking about the possibility of some sort of God, some sort of creator, some sort of creating principle, and saying any kind of limitations that I try to put on this immediately negate or sort of cut away at the infinite possibility of like a supreme being or a supreme force or an original generative force, right? If I, you know, if I start saying, you know, there's actually like this God has this type of personality and this God has an interest in this specific thing only, and et cetera, I'm not really being true to this idea that there must be like some fundamental basic energy or principle. You know, it's got to be the whole thing. It's got to see as a whole. It's got to know as a whole. It's got to hear as a whole. And that's, you know, and that's where we kind of get this idea of like on, you know, the omnipotent God, the like the all seeing, all creating, always has been, always will be, you know, primary being.
Yeah. And omnipotent Absolutely, in this next fragment, but without toil, he moves everything by the thought of his mind, which is really interesting that there is a God. I think in the commentaries that I was reading, if he's sort of all powerful, then he doesn't need to. And so this is one of the interesting things to the next fragment. I'll relate these two. He always remains in the same place, not moving at all, nor is it fitting for him to change his position at different times. Well, if he can move everything by the thought of his mind, he doesn't need to move. Anything that he desires, he can bring towards him. He doesn't need to change in any way.
Again, like, we're transitioning away from, you know, or this is a rejection of gods as a kind of collection of, like, basically superheroes, effectively, right? Like a collection of superheroes, of super beings who control different aspects of the world and have their own select little areas, and they're always kind of in tension with each other, and they're always in tension with human beings as well, you know, and they have their own, you know, histories and concerns and little dramas going on and relationships, and they're all sleeping with each other, of course, right? Like, and here, you know, here we've got a picture of some sort of god-like being who honestly comes across much more like what we're going to see a lot later with monotheistic religion. He is like the father of all and is, you know, thinking about the famous, you know, Abrahamic period quote, like, you know, who are you, says Moses to the burning bush, and all the response is just, I am everything. I am all, I've always been.
It is interesting. It's so the other thing to kind of go into this as well is that there is this real question of whether it's like a genuine metaphysical monism. Is it a monotheism as well? Because if we look at that first fragment, or not the first fragment, but there is one God among gods and men and the greatest, not at all like mortals in body or mind. Xenophanes is permitting the existence of gods. So there is one God among gods. But what I find really interesting about the, and when we get into the epistemological fragments of Xenophanes, where he's talking about, it's not in your collection, but there is a fragment that I'll read. And the one called Iris is also a cloud. So Xenophanes really likes clouds. He's like ostensibly the earth guy, because he says that all things come from earth and return to earth. But his actual mechanical explanation for lots of stuff is clouds. He says, and the one called Iris, so Iris is the god of like rainbows and is a god, a messenger of the gods. And the one called Iris is also a cloud, purple, red, and yellow to the sight. So what's really interesting I find about this is that Xenophanes is not just saying Iris doesn't exist, because a Greek would be like, well, what are you talking about? Like, we've both seen rainbows before. What he's trying to do is he's doing what good scientific theories do, and that's that they're theoretically conservative. They have to explain all the stuff that previous theories explained, but then explain more stuff, right? So he's saying, actually, you can explain these gods. They are natural phenomenon. Iris is like some clouds, but also there's this other more divine principle. I'm expanding the scope of what is really there. And we can't really know about this one God. We can know all kinds of stuff about these more, you know, Iris, it's clouds, but this other one you can't know about.
This actually makes a lot of sense because, you know, we have a tendency, especially being, you know, really most familiar with monotheistic religions, like Christianity, Islam currently, where it's kind of like a zero sum game. A little bit in terms of like either my religion is true or your religion is true, like there's gonna be one, but that's not really the religious world that someone like Xenophanes would have been in. Rejecting other people's gods or rejecting gods from other places and stuff wasn't really a common practice in the same sort of way, right? Like different societies, communities had different gods. Oftentimes those gods were traded and moved around and adopted by other societies, and it was kind of accepted, like, you know, the Egyptians across the Mediterranean, for example, if I was saying ancient Greek, like they believe in Horus and Iris, and like they have their, like their gods are like effectively real, like those are, that's their pantheon of gods supporting them, helping them, who they pray to. And we might even borrow and choose from, pick and choose from each other a little bit. And so I think what Xenophanes is really doing here is not so much rejecting other you know, other pantheons and other gods as saying, like, again, like, they're these kind of recesses. Their world is real. Like, there's gods. There's probably, I'm anticipating a little bit. I'm taking a chance here. But I believe he's probably saying, like, there's gods. Their world is real. Like, they're doing their thing. But they don't, that doesn't explain, like, the gods, like, the realm of the gods does not explain the world primarily, right? Like, there needs to be, like, the, you know, basically this, the Supa god, you know, the ultimate god. And this being can't be anthropomorphic, can't be limited, right? Like, this is a sort of oneness and an omnipotent being. And, like, don't make the mistake that he's like you, because he's not.
Yeah. But, and the interesting thing too is that, kind of taking the, so this is, like, one of the things that the commentaries that I read mentioned, was that Xenophanes is, like, for all intents and purposes, an Ionian, right? He's still influenced by the Milesian schools. He would have encountered these. Intellectually, they would have been quite informative. So these are going to inform his epistemology. Obviously, his travels are showing the kind of folly of people just taking otherwise explainable and commensurate phenomena like the gods and taking them as absolutes. His travels have shown those to be, you have alternate explanations for these. With regards to his one god, this monotheistic god, the Xenophanian god, this one, he says, you can't really broach this. You can't have knowledge because this god is beyond your perceptions. It's not just a mist of cloud like Iris. It's not just an eruption at a volcano. It's not just the crack of lightning. This is a god beyond the world. This is a god that any claim that we can say about this one god, we can't really know because our senses are limited. So there is a fragment.
I was going to read read the fragment right now. Xenophanes says, no man knows or ever will know the truth about the gods and about everything I speak of. For even if one chanced to say the complete truth, yet oneself knows it not, but seeming is wrought over all things.
And this is the, I think, what is getting anticipated by Pherecydes, but is being intellectually or sort of rationally demonstrated by the Milesians, is that if the Milesians are trying to explain a world order, a cosmic principle that undergirds all of the appearances, Xenophanes is really kind of just articulating the logical consequence, or at least the epistemological lesson of that, which is this really pithy saying. I actually think it's quite good. Seeming is wrought over all things. The world seems a certain way to us, but the way that the world is a different matter than the way that it seems to us. And there's a certain amount of intellectual humility you need to exercise when you want to be making claims about the world. And he's applying that I think he's kind of tacking his one god above the gods as a kind of intellectual limit, a boundary mark, as it were, to that humility. You can't know this, and you can approach it, maybe. Seeming is wrought over things. There's other fragments where he says, like, yes, we can investigate more, and it would make a lot of sense because Xenophanes went out and traveled a lot, and he learned a lot of things, and he acquired some pretty reasonable knowledge from that. So there is progress, but don't think that you get some absolute knowledge by just going and looking at stuff. So that's the other fragment. We have it here in your collection as well. Not from the beginning have the gods revealed all things to mortals, but by long seeking, men find what is better. So we can know about things and we can explain them, but what is really going on behind what seems to us, there's a certain amount of intellectual humility we have to exercise in that regard.
Absolute knowledge is a hard thing to gain, but our knowledge can improve. And there's an activity of investigation. And that's really, in many ways, what the first philosophers, early philosophical schools, were doing exactly that. I mean, obviously, especially early on, like, even all the most basic natural sciences were under the umbrella of philosophy. You don't have to take myths and stories at face value. We can go out there and try to come up with ideas and explanations that make more sense, that have more explanatory power than previously. And that's a huge shift. And you see that in Xenophanes' own work, where it's like, basically, it's like, you guys, this is kind of weird that, like, we have, like, this drama in the sky, right? Like, we have this
Isn't that curious? Unethical drama
in the sky. Couldn't we do better? You know, there's got to be some sort of, you know, originating principle or being or deity. And, like, also, too, like, it seems ridiculous that, like, you know, we think of them just like us. Why would that be the case? You tell me stuff, but I have no reason to believe what you tell me. Right? I can easily bracket what you're telling me and put it aside and have an explanation that makes more sense.
Yeah, I can take your claim about something and I can explain it myself. You think that you've gotten to some ground. Well, actually, I can take the ground right out from underneath you in that sense. Yeah, that is interesting. I think for our next episode, we will be reading Heraclitus. Heraclitus has some things to say about Xenophanes that actually sound quite similar, but at the same time, Heraclitus is critical of Xenophanes. For Heraclitus, wide learning does not teach insight. Xenophanes' intellectual humility is really called for, but then you read Parmenides.
You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Oh, that's real good. CJSF 90.